Thank you, Vince. It's great to be here with you. Thank you for your hospitality. It's great to be here at Wheaton. You know, first time I've heard of Wheaton was while I was a 15-year-old kid in former Yugoslavia. My then-to-be brother-in-law had studied at Wheaton, got his MA in textual criticism with Gordon Fee. Here, and my brother-in-law was profoundly influential in my own intellectual life, and hence Wheaton has had impact on me, and so I'm delighted to be here. Some of my great friends are both graduates and teachers here, so it's with great pleasure that I'm here. Christianity and Islam, God of Jesus Christ and the God of Muhammad, relationship between these two. Some aspect of this relationship is our topic for tonight. Now, the issue about which I will be speaking is not whether Muslims will or will not go to heaven. That's a very important question that people often ask and want pursued. I will bracket it completely tonight. My question tonight is this one. How can Muslims and Christians, who comprise more than half of humanity, how can they live together in a single world? Now, this question is important for us, I think, partly because we live in an interconnected, and even more importantly, highly interdependent world. We also are, because we are interdependent, profoundly intertwined as well. And as it happens, we live in the era of both growing and assertive religions, publicly assertive religions. Intertwined with assertive religions, that some people think is a recipe for conflict. And indeed, in many parts of the world, it has been a source of significant conflict. Now, some people have hoped that they would be able to eliminate religion, if not completely, then certainly as a factor in public life. That clearly has not succeeded, and if one tries to do that, I think the result would be increased oppression and violence rather than in any way decreased. Another project was to try to sequester religious groups, the traditionally cuius regio, eius religio, whose rule that one's religion also will be the dominant one. That has been tried as well, but in the context of an interdependent, intertwined world, that is a non-starter. There may be some religiously pure areas in the world today, but increasingly they're disappearing. We are intertwined. And also, some people have tried to kind of lock the faith in the privacy of worshippers' hearts and not let it come to have a public expression. That too has failed, and partly is failing because majority of religious people, and that's true of Muslims, some Christians are surprised at that, but the majority of people, religious people in the world, embrace the democratic ideal. Now, if you embrace the democratic ideal and you belong to one of the prophetic faiths, one of the faiths which demands of its worshippers, of its followers, to shape the world in the light of God's revelation, if you belong to one of those prophetic faiths, what will you do if you embrace democracy as an ideal? Well, you will have your faith, you will attempt at least to have your faith shape the public realm. So we live together, religious communities intertwined together and with assertive religions. How will we live together? I think we can live together only if we have some common set of values. And that's where the question of whether Muslims and Christians believe in the same God becomes one of the major, broadly speaking, one of the major political questions. Why? Because if you are a monotheist, as Christians and Muslims are, then your ultimate values are all embodied in that God whom you worship. And those ultimate and fundamental values, if they clash, if you don't worship the same God, if you worship radically different gods, then your fundamental values will clash. And likelihood that in an interdependent world with assertive religions we are able to live together is relatively small. My question then is it true that Muslims and Christians worship a different God, or is it rather true that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, though understood in partly different ways? And my argument is Muslims and Christians do worship the same God, partly differently understood. I'll try to explicate that a little bit later on, but I put it there as a thesis at the very beginning. I know you'll come back at me and we'll discuss that, and if everything else failed, you can read my book and then come back to me again. But for now, let me continue, and the question and answer period will deal with any concerns that you might have. How to live together in a common world. Now, in May of 2005, it was a decade after the war ended in Bosnia. I come from former Yugoslavia. I followed the war in Bosnia very, very carefully. I returned back to one of the conferences, about Muslim-Christian relations, Building Bridges conferences, and we were discussing the topic Muslims and Christians and the common good, right in the middle of Sarajevo, after about 10 years after Sarajevo, after the war in former Yugoslavia. Meetings as they were going on, discussions about these issues, meeting with dignitaries of all three of faiths, Catholic, Orthodox, Muslim, all of this weighed too heavily on me, and so I sought solace in a friendship with my very good Franciscan friend, who's a Franciscan theologian, and I went out with him for dinner, and as we were returning back in the evening, we were discussing the topic of our conference, Muslims and Christians and the common good. We're walking through the streets of Sarajevo, and he tells me very abruptly, surprisingly, he said, "We have lost the fear of God." And I think, okay, Ivo, what has fear of God to do with the common good? Now, by fear of God, he didn't mean a kind of a constraining sense that all our moves must be approved by some overbearing potentate. He meant something, a relationship in which we give to God ultimate allegiance, in that God is that one who fundamentally and ultimately matters to us. So fear of God. He said then to me, new mosques are springing left and right, and the old ones are being restored to new glory. Largely, he said, this is not a revival of deep spirituality seeking spaces for outward expression and nurture. These building projects are political acts. Muslims are asserting their identity and marking their territory. The war with guns and tanks is over. The war with religious symbols has begun. As I was listening to this, I thought, wow, sacred objects as weapons in secular struggles. Struggles for territory, right? Struggles for domination. Now, if anything is secularization of religion, that's what secularization of religion is. Employment of religion for utterly secular purposes. won't take long before the mask of religion will be taken. You'll see it as a naked grab for power for what it actually is. As I was thinking about that, I thought also, well, and I told him, Ivo, but we Christians aren't much better, are we? And I was thinking not so much of Sarajevo, but of another city, a little bit south of Mostar. And the city of Mostar, city where I lived for a whole year, Catholics, who dominated the city, have built a 100-foot cross on the mountain overlooking the valley in which the city was. At night it is lit, and it is the same spot from which Muslims were shelled during the war, was now dominated by that cross. So again, a religious symbol as a weapon in struggles. And my friend responded, Franciscan friend responded, well, Miroslav, you make my point. Christians and Muslims alike use sacred objects to occupy spaces and celebrate their own identities. And then he said, they do so because they fear each other, but they don't fear God. Religion is a marker of identity. That religion has swallowed up allegiance to the one God, and I would say to the one common God. And even though God is on everyone's lips, religion has become godless. Maybe religion has become godless because God is on everyone's lips. Once you talk too much about God, I begin to be suspicious. Now that's from a person who is a deeply committed Orthodox Christian. Each community thinks only of its own injuries, of its own hopes, pursuing only its own interests and its own good, neither cares for the other, nor from the common good. How can we care for the common good if we don't worship, if we don't give allegiance to something or someone who is common to us both? The fear of God, it says in the wisdom literature, is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of God, I think my friend suggested, is the beginning of the political wisdom, of our ability to live together in a multi-religious state. Now, as he was talking about the fear of God and the importance of the fear of God, and as he was kind of tearing down Islam and Christianity as religions, don't misunderstand me, it's not as allegiance to God, but as kind of religious edifices, I thought immediately of a great 20th century theologian, Karl Barth. He began his career by rebelling against religion. Not against God, against religion. What kind of religion? Religion reduced to culture, to a certain kind of morality. Religion twisted into a kind of cultural resource, a marker of group identity. He was a Swiss village pastor. And his rebellion against religion turned him into a world-class theologian. Well, not just that, right? But that, especially. What happened? In August 1914, German Kaiser Wilhelm declared war on Russia and France. He asked the great liberal theologian, Adolf Harnack. Some of you have read some of Harnack's works, I assume, here. He asked Adolf von Harnack to help him draft a speech addressed to the German nation after the beginning of the war. Harnack complied. Later, along with another liberal theologian by the name of Wilhelm Hermann, Harnack also signed the famous petition of 93 leading German intellectuals in support of the German cause. German militarism is a protector of German culture, they declare. In the land of Kant, Goethe, and Beethoven, freedom and culture will thrive only if it doesn't shy away from using, only if the nation doesn't shy away from using its weapons. Both Harnack and Hermann were Barth's teachers. Barth was a Swiss citizen. He had a bit of distance from the German insanity. And he thought that the Christian faith of his great teachers is nothing but a Christianized version of German culture and of Enlightenment morality. It's now turned aggressive. He rejected it as mere religion. By mere religion, he meant self-aggrandizing and dangerous betrayal of the true faith, parading as the gold standard of morality and enlightened religiosity. What's at the heart of the true faith for Karl Barth? It's the fear of the Lord. The Bible has only one all-encompassing interest, he argued, and that is the interest in God himself. He put it very simply, God is God. You can't say it more simply than that, right? God is God. God alone is God. And therefore, God demands our entire obedience. God, Barth insisted, cannot be grasped, brought under management, or put to use. Now that was essential for him. God cannot, ought not be put to use. He cannot serve. God cannot serve. God must rule. When you read his texts, and if you forget about the cultural background and political background in which he is writing, you might think that Barth's turn to God was utterly otherworldly, detached from history, culture, politics, and from the common good. And yet, it was not. It was a battle cry against the idol of religion and the world for which it provides a sacred canopy. World of group identities, national interest, a world of cleansed territories, a world of exclusion, world of enmities and aggression. When the idol of religion is smashed and God acknowledged as God, what happens to the world? Well, it appears as a unity, and then the search for the common good can begin. We live about a century after Barth's initial battle cry. And Muslims and Christians today may be in somewhat similar situation as Barth was during World War I. The thunder of wars in which Muslims and Christians are involved continues unabated, and tensions between the two run high in the West, as well as in the majority Muslim countries. Religious leaders and combatants both invoke religion in support of their cause. The terrorists who flew planes into the Twin Towers were instructed in their manual, remember, this is a battle for the sake of God. For the influential, well, maybe not anymore, but then influential TV evangelist and former presidential candidate Pat Robertson, the whole conflict between Islam and the West is the contest whether the moon god of Mecca, known as Allah, is supreme, or whether Judeo-Christian Jehovah, the God of the Bible, is supreme. Now, not all talk about God is really talk about God. Some of it is false, some of it is about false gods, and much of it is about culture, territory, and identity, and much of it is therefore very deeply divisive and dangerous. And I think Christians and Muslims can both rebel against such misuse of the name of God and unite together in the fear of God. Maybe that might open up the possibility for them, for us, to pursue something like the common good, or simply to be able to live together under the common roof. Now, you will say everything that I've said so far presupposes, in fact, that they do, that Muslims and Christians do worship the same God. But is it true that they worship the same God? I'll offer only brief comments about this. Maybe if you want further exploration, we can talk during the question and answer period. Now, my argument is relatively simple in this regard. I distinguish between referent, God as referent of our language, and the description of that referent, description of who God is. And if you ask me, do Muslims and Christians have the same object in mind when they refer to God? I think the answer to this question is an unambiguous yes. They have exactly the same object in mind. Why? Well, because Muslims and Christians, just about all Muslims and Christians, believe that, one, God has created the world. By the world, Muslims and Christians mean everything else that is not God, right? God created everything else that exists that is not God. God is one. And God can in no way be identified or confused with the world. It is not that somehow world emerges out of God's, as kind of God's body, right? God is distinct, categorically even distinct from the world. Now, I think if you affirm these three claims, Muslims and Christians do, I think you have to say something like this. If God were an object to whom you could point, we know that God isn't such an object, or at least theologians tell us that God isn't such an object. Do you doubt that? Footnote. Lectures have footnotes, right? If papers have footnotes, lectures have footnotes too. So footnote. Why is it that we cannot point to God? Not because God is really, really far away, and so when we point, we don't see anything, but fundamentally because God is categorically different than the world. God is not an object in this world. One of my colleagues, Dennis Turner, has said, well, imagine somebody has this crazy experiment. He's going to or she's going to enumerate all different things that exist in the world. And let's say that all the number of all these different things that exist in the world is n, right? And then somebody says to that person, well, wait a second, you've forgotten one very, very important fact in the world, and that's God. And now that person says, aha, no, I've gotten the number wrong. Number is n plus 1, right? That's not how it works, because God is not part of the world, categorically different. Therefore, we cannot really point to God. End of my footnote, back to the main text we go. Okay? Now, if we could point to God, if Muslims and Christians could point to God, there would be only one and only one object they could point to, if they have these three, share these three convictions. And that is that one to whom we refer when we speak about God. Now, so that's the question about the referent for God. Now, the important question is also about the description of God. Well, you may say it's very well that the referent of our language about God is the same, but is the description of that God the same too? And here the answer is a bit more complicated. And the answer goes something like that. The description is sufficiently similar. In both tradition, God's moral character of God is not the same, but it's sufficiently similar. God is just and God is merciful. God commands roughly in both tradition for us to obey 10 commandments. No, it's really 9 commandments, because the Sabbath command is not enjoined either in Quran or in the Bible, Christians at least don't think that they need to necessarily follow it. So 9 commands are the same, right? Well, if we come, we have some of our Christian reasons for it, right? It's not just arbitrary that we decided we don't want to obey this 7th command, right? So my suggestion is, well, that then the character description of God is sufficiently similar. Now, some of you might say, now that's not quite enough. And one person put its argument against the position like I'm advocating, like this. So with God, it is like with money. If you have 2 banknotes, and you know which one's genuine, right? And the other one just slightly is different than the genuine one, then you'll know that you have a counterfeit money, right? And he said, well, that's exactly how it is with God. If the picture of God only slightly differs from the one that we have in the Bible, the God whom Jesus has revealed, the God, that God or God, must be a false God. I think that's a wrong kind of an argument, because God is not like a banknote. I think we have to instead operate with the principle of sufficient similarity. Now, my argument, or my statement rather right now, is that there is sufficient similarity between Muslims and Christian conceptions of God so that we can say that they worship the same and similarly understood God, which provides the basis, I think, for some of very significant common values. It doesn't mean that there'll be agreement. It means that there's a basis on which possible agreement can be reached, right? Let me now make a few more comments, and then I will open the floor for discussion. For Christians, certainly, the issue is not simply rightly identifying God, knowing rightly who it is that God is. For Christians, fundamental question is also worshiping God and worshiping God rightly. I take it that it's uncontested that in the Christian tradition, we worship God in 2 ways, by loving God and by loving our neighbors. Loving our neighbors is a mode of worship of that God. Why? Because this is God's command. It's more complicated than that, but basically it boils down to this. So, you worship God in what you do, how you live in the world, right? Now, this is a preliminary comment. Now, during the Cold War, when I was growing up in the former Yugoslavia, there was a debate going on between communism and Christianity, right? That was a big struggle that was going on. And within that struggle, one of the French philosophers, Christian philosophers, has come up with a distinction between theoretical atheists and practical atheists. Now, we all know what theoretical atheists are. Those are the folks who have as their responsible intellectual position denial that God exists. Now, what is a practical atheist? Well, practical atheist is the one who affirms that God exists, but in the way in which they live, they actually deny God. They live as if there were no God. They deny God's commandments, right? They say then that they worship God, but in fact, they do not. Now, you remember prophets have railed against this kind of religiosity. Fasting, prayers, take them away, the noise of your prayers from me, let justice roll, right? God cannot be worshipped properly with our prayers unless God is worshipped in our deeds. Now, Jesus has given a kind of twist to that idea. You remember that Jesus said, you cannot worship God and mammon. It's not just now, he says, that you can do all the outward rituals, but in fact not worship God, which is what the prophet said, you actually, when you can actually worship something else than God, while at the same time claiming that you worship God, right? You can worship money, you can worship nation, whatever else. And Martin Luther picked up the idea and suggested, well, what is God? God is that in which you place your trust. That is your God. That's who you worship. No matter what you say with your mind, with your mouth, what your profession is, your action tell us what it is that you actually place your trust in. What is it that you actually worship? It's a practical worship of God. Now, all of this, I said, in order to give you a historical contrast, background for a historical contrast. And the historical contrast that I want to draw for you concerns the Crusades. In 1099, June of 1099, Jerusalem was captured by Crusaders. And it happened on noonday hour on Friday, the day of the week when Christ redeemed the whole world on the cross. Crusaders took Jerusalem and butchered all of Jerusalem inhabitants. Here is a report by a Christian. Nowhere was there a place where Muslims could escape the swordsmen. Not even in Solomon's temple. And then he continues. On the top of Solomon's temple, to which they had climbed in fleeing, many were shot to death with arrows and cast down headlong from the roof. Within this temple, about 10,000 were beheaded. If you had been there, your feet would have been stained up to the ankles with the blood of the slain. What more shall I tell? Not one of them was allowed to live. They did not spare women and children. Now, you can put next to this scene of cruel crusaders from the Middle Ages, you can imagine contemporary scene, a Muslim terrorist blowing himself up to kill and maim the innocent and spread uncertainty and fear. Are the crusaders and the terrorists worshiping the same God? Crusader shouts, "Christ is the Lord," and cleaves the head of the infidel. A terrorist, Muslim terrorist, shouts, "Allahu Akbar," God is the greatest, and he pulls the fuse of the bomb strapped around his waist. They're naming God very differently. And yet they are, I think, worshiping the same God, a bloodthirsty God of power, not the God of justice and mercy of the normative Christian and Muslim religious traditions. Now, when it comes to practices, the fundamental issue is not whether Muslims and Christians believe and worship the same God. It is whether they worship the true God. One more twist to this, as if this was not challenging enough, and then I will end. If you return to Jerusalem about 100 years later, struggles of Christians and Muslims for rule over Jerusalem were going on. In 1187, the Muslim ruler Salah ad-Din, or Saladin, recaptured Jerusalem. Now, unlike the Crusaders a century earlier, he spared the inhabitants' lives. He offered safe passage with all their possessions to those who could pay a ransom. 10 dinars for males, 5 dinars for females, too bad for your girls, didn't work quite as well, 1 for children. Those who could not pay ransom were less fortunate. They became booty and could be killed. Now, it's interesting. Commenting on Saladin's offer, a Christian eyewitness writes, "This agreement pleased the Lord Patriarch and the others who had money." Right? Those who had money, they could leave. But what about those who did not have money? Crowds, there's a report, crowds throughout the city wailed in sorrowful tones, "Woe, woe to us, miserable people, we have no gold. What are we to do?" Now, significantly, the anger of the poor was not directed against Saladin, but against their wealthy Christians who could not help their poor co-religionists. The same report, Christian report, writes, "Alas, by hands of wicked Christians, Jerusalem was turned over to the wicked." Now, these wicked Christians looked even worse after Saladin, their enemy and conqueror, released 1,000 of the poor residents without ransom. I can assure you that Saladin did not believe that God was the Holy Trinity. I can assure you that he did not believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And it's unlikely that he believed that Jesus Christ died for the sin of the world, as we Christians rightly do. But I ask you, might he not have been with his deeds worshiping the one true God better than did the Crusaders when they butchered all the inhabitants of Jerusalem? Thank you very much.